Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Conscious Thought with Leo on BBS Radio Talk Show, and I'm your host, Magdalena Winkler. Well, tonight we will actually have a great speaker again. He's an award-winning author, co-author, international trainer, and expert on edible perennial gardening and sustainable permaculture, Eric Tonsmeyer. Good evening, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Listen, I'm so excited. Finally, we made it.
Yes, thank you for your patience.
You are welcome. And listen, I so much appreciate, you know, you taking your extra time and be here with our listeners. Because this year I decided, bring more information that can actually bring us more hope what's really going in the world. And I decided you would be one of the, a great people who can bring actually great information. So what I would love you, Eric, to do, give us a little more about your bio. Who are you and what are you doing? Because you can do this much better than I do.
Sure thing. Well, my name is Eric Tonsmeyer. Mm-hmm. Let's see. About 25 years ago, I got interested in permaculture and particularly in the food forest part of permaculture, this idea of having multiple layers of trees and shrubs and vines and herbs with maybe fungi and livestock producing food and working like an ecosystem. So I spent about 25 years working on that. And I've added in a lot of farm business management. I ran a seed company. I ran an urban farm for a number of years. And for the last 5 or 6 years, I've been working on agricultural solutions to climate change, which
this is why I wanted you to be here. Yes. Thank you, Eric. Mm-hmm. Go for it. Sorry for interruption.
Well, no, that's all. I also, at this point, I'm a lecturer at Yale University. I teach one class a semester there, and I work with a group called Drawdown, which is we're sort of taking 100 climate solutions and running numbers to find out their climate impact and economic impact by 2045 if they were widely adopted. So I'm sort of solutions oriented and looking at ecological solutions to various social and environmental problems.
Yeah, this is why I really liked it about you, because you know what you do, you're really, spending your energy in regenerative agriculture practice, and it's practically that, which is actually great for climate change. You're working also in mitigation and in a food security. And also, I really wanted to kind of, bring to our listener attention that you just wrote, you actually got a new book on the market. So we will wanted to talk about that too tonight.
Sure. Well, our timing turned out perfect because the book just came out, and I've been working on it for a long time. I raised money to write it back in 2013. So I spent 3 years working on it, and it just came out. It's called The Carbon Farming Solution. What's the subtitle? A Global Toolkit of Perennial Crops and Regenerative Agriculture Practices for Climate Change Mitigation and Food Security.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a long title, but it's a long book. It's about 500 pages long. So,
listen, I saw it. It's like, oh my God, this is a huge amount of information.
It was a very exciting and demanding process to pull together. What I'm most pleased about is there's beautiful color photographs all through, and I think that the photos really tell the story. They inspire people to keep going reading their way through dense text. I find photos from around the world of different kinds of practices. There's so many different practices, farming practices that fight climate change. So I'm showing a whole range of those and people doing them from all over the world. So it's fun to see all the world's people and their different farming.
Yeah. Systems. See, Eric, this is what was so fascinating for me is that you are actually incorporating, I would almost say, the global culture, the global population. You are not just kind of here on the North American continent. You are kind of incorporating everything. So, and that is what is so amazing to me, because this is almost look like the permaculture. You can use permaculture almost in lot of different, you know, situations. I would not say in every culture, climate, you know, because sometimes, you know, when you have a cold climate, we may have challenges. But, you know, if we have erosions or you know, rains and droughts, so, you know, you can actually help so much with the permaculture. So I would like to know, you know, what motivated you to kind of go into that direction?
Sure. Well, I was, I've been studying these kinds of farming systems and gardening systems as well for a long time, with an emphasis on perennial plants, mostly because I'm lazy and I don't like working as much in my garden. And I find that trees are easier to grow than tomatoes and potatoes and stuff.
Well, this is beautiful about the permaculture. You can do so many different things. Exactly.
We do like things that are easier to go. It's science. It's not laziness, right? We like to justify our low maintenance approach. But it was about 5 or 6 years ago that I realized that that these. I heard somebody. I was reading a book, and the author said that, well, replanting trees, replanting forests is a great way to fight climate change, but there isn't enough land to plant enough forest to make a difference because we have to save land for agriculture. And I thought, well, you know, there are trees that are agriculture and there's farming systems that use trees. So I guess I have something to contribute to this conversation. And it's been really fun working on the book. It's the only time ever in my life when I've looked at climate change and just the more I learned, the more hopeful I got about what was possible.
Well, you know, I was watching some of your videos and I realized you are so passionate about that. And this is the beauty of it, because, you know, you bring so much energy and so much information into it. It's just amazing to me.
Well, thank you. I tend to be the kind of person who really enjoys details. I like making tables of different species from around the world, and I like researching numbers and pulling all those things together. And it doesn't look to me... I looked and looked and I couldn't find anywhere where anyone had pulled all this kind of information together. So I tried to really bring together from the worlds of botany and the world of agriculture and agroforestry and some of the policy research and financing and stuff to pull all those things in one place to give people a launching point, not to answer all their questions, not to tell them all of what to do, but to give... farmers and communities and policymakers and funders and researchers a place.
Eric, do you have all this in your book?
Oh yes. Oh yes.
Oh yeah. Awesome.
It's very detailed.
Well, listen, I'm just asking because, you know, you may just convince me to get it. Even though it's so thick.
I put a lot of stuff from the book up on my, I have a website for it, which is carbonfarmingsolution.com. So I've put a bunch of my favorite videos on there, and all a bunch of the tables from the book are up there for free for,
yeah, you have huge information on your download. Website. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So trying to make it, and all my favorite readings that I was inspired by for the book or found most helpful, I've put links to. So I'm trying to make it easy for people who don't want to buy an expensive, thick, intimidating book to get the basic idea in a mm-hmm. In a more friendly format.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have to say that because, you know, I mean, I grew up, Eric, on the farm in Europe. And when I came here, you know, I mean, a few years ago, I heard about permaculture and I read a little about and I said, nah, you know, I grew up on the farm. And by age 15, I was so sick and tired of it. Uh-huh. But, you know, in November last year, when I went to the class with Corinne and when I met her, 10 minutes in the class, I have to tell you, I was sold. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I'm sharing this with you is that because there are so many people outside, they don't know what permaculture is. Because the permaculture is still a new kid on the block. Let's be honest.
It is. You know? And one of the things I learned about this book is that a lot of things that I always sort of thought were things that permaculture made up mm-hmm. really are things that people have been doing often for thousands of years around the world since long before permaculture came along. And what's unique about permaculture is just tying all those things together into one system. But we didn't invent the food forest and we didn't invent A lot of these things, they're very old, and some of them are practiced on a very, very wide scale, or very large scale around the world. And that was inspiring to learn as well. I sort of began partly thinking that carbon farming was maybe these new wild and crazy ideas that were just getting started, and to learn that some of these practices are already being done on huge amounts of the world's land, like some of them on hundreds of millions of acres, you know, is very encouraging that there a lot of these are really ready to go. They're ready to be scaled up very quickly.
Well,
and
see,
they make
again,
farmers' lives better, which would make your 16-year-old life better as well.
Exactly. Well, see, this is why I'm bringing you folks here and, you know, introduce you or reintroduce you actually to the public that, wait a minute, this is not look like the old farming. You can actually, you know, get much more production on a small scale. I mean, I am fascinated with forest farming. You know, so look, you are talking about being lazy. Yeah, I wanted to put least amount of effort to get the most out. So
that sounds good to me. I've been doing this for 25 years and it's really never gotten boring. So
exactly.
There's a lot to learn. There's so many cool species and cool fruits from around the world. And in this book, I do 6 chapters on the perennial staple crops of the world, like the protein and carbohydrates and fats that grow on trees around the world. And then 6 more on things we can use to replace petroleum. So industrial oils and plants for bioplastics and plants for textiles, perennial plants for textiles, and all kinds of things that we can use as the basis of human civilization on that grow in perennial carbon sequestering plants and can be grown in these food forest systems or other sometimes simpler and larger scale agroforestry systems. It was really a lot of fun. And there's about 700 species total that I cover in the book. So that's plenty of biodiversity for any of us to get started.
Absolutely. And, you know, another thing what I actually liked that I was listening to one of you things, interviews and, videos, and you were talking about what we need, you know, to succeed. We have to actually redo the global civilization. Practically, we need a new mind here, new consciousness, you know, that can actually open themselves and, make a space for this a new information because, we are constantly bombarded with this gloom and doom about, climate change. Yes, this, a lot of stuff is happening. But also people do not recognize we have an enormous amount of possibilities. Yeah. This is what is so fascinating to me.
Absolutely. And one of the things I learned from this book is that the technical questions of mitigating climate change, of bringing the atmospheric level of these greenhouse gases back to a level that's really compatible with civilization. The technical part of that isn't difficult. We know much of what needs to be done. Reduce emissions like clean energy and changes to transportation and regional planning and levels of consumption and things like that on the one hand. And we know also what needs to be done to draw that excess carbon back down through restoring healthy ecosystems and implementing these different kinds of carbon farming practices, whether they're better ways to grow annual crops, better ways to grow livestock, or most powerfully using perennial crops. That none of that is really contested by scientists. It's a matter of having the building a global movement in order to put pressure on governments and also for all of us to get started and not wait for governments because they are coming along last, especially here in the United States. Our government is not on the forefront of climate change.
That's a great aspect, Eric, because I also wanted to kind of touch a little, on that when I called you, you were actually preparing yourself to go to the Paris climate talk, remember? And, my question was, how did that go? Because, that was actually, outside, from United States. So how the people, over there dealing with this kind of situations?
Sure. Well, first for me personally, as a climate activist from the United States, or a climate, whatever you want to call me, climate professional from the United States. It was wonderful to be somewhere where no one was denying that climate change is real. That was that was great. And it was very interesting. Both, I got a chance to be part of to meet with sort of real kind of activists, grassroots organizations, to be part of some NGO type activity, and to get to be part of the government forum as well. And actually, the most powerful part of the whole experience for me was being I was on a panel about these kinds of farming practices for delegates from all over sub-Saharan Africa. And to hear them talking about the kinds of challenges that they're facing right now and that they're likely to face in the future, I could really see that there are lots of people in governments in some parts of the world who take this very seriously. I learned, for example, that in West Africa, there's a big rainforest area, and then as you move inland, you get into a drier savanna, and that savanna is moving about 30 or 40 miles a year into the rainforest. That is, the rainforest is drying out about 30, 40 miles every year.
Whoa.
And to hear what are the challenges that farmers are facing who've been farming in a humid climate all their life in a rainforest, and suddenly it's drying out rapidly. I got to really see that these practices, many of which involve better ways to harvest rainwater more efficiently, to integrate some trees that can help provide some shade and help cool down crops and livestock and people and so on in these hotter climates. It was very moving, and I was able to give away a bunch of pre-ordered, we bound up some early black and white editions of the book that were like kind of drafts, you know, and I gave away a bunch of those to folks from some of those countries, including someone from the finance ministry of Zambia and things like that. And that was really a real treat. And I was actually invited by one of the other folks on the panel to go and speak this year at the World Agroforestry Center in Nairobi, Kenya, which is going to be a real pleasure to be there. So I could see that some countries are in the places where the impacts are being felt on people now. People are taking this very seriously. Governments are taking this very seriously indeed. And
so what is it possible for us here, Eric, to do? Because, you know, I mean, you can read here so much that, you know, how much our farmers are facing, how much challenges. And, you know, we as a consumer, for instance, we are asking, the food to be labeled. You know, a lot of people are not interested to have GMO stuff and everything else. But, you know, everybody is facing such a huge amount of challenges. And I don't know, it's this lack of misinformation, non-information, or what can we do? I mean, it's frustrating. Let's just put the least.
It is. It's one of many challenges, and particularly again in here in the U.S., it's sort of extra challenging. Let's see, what can one do? Well, actually, I have a whole section in the back of the book about what you can do. As an ordinary person, as a consumer, as a farmer, as a student, and so on, what are the different kinds of things people can do? Because there's really roles for everyone. So there's roles everyone can play. So as an individual, one thing you can do is plant some edible trees, plant some fruit trees, plant some berry bushes. That's sequestering carbon, and it's also reducing food miles. If they're within walking distance or biking distance or busing distance of your house, they're really reducing the emissions of your food getting to you. Let's see, I'll just pull out the book and I'll read some of my favorite ones from that section.
Here we go.
What can you do? What can you do? Well, you can put some pressure on your government to do a few things and not wait. Let's see, I got them right here on that last chapter.
I like this.
Individuals. We have put a political price on climate change denial and failure to act. Vote out or throw out politicians who are not part of the solution.
I like that.
Dramatically reduce your consumption. Eat like you care about the planet. Adopt a diet rich in carbon sequestering foods with short supply chains. educate. No one knows everything, so learn what you can, what you're passionate about, and share that knowledge with others. So there's lots of different things we can all do. There's so much. One of the interesting things about addressing climate change, to do it in a serious way that will really work, involves changing a lot of things about our civilization and the way things are done. A lot of which sort of were overdue for some changes to them anyway. So it provides an opportunity for us to right some other wrongs at the same time, like to change over some of the maybe chemical intensive model of agriculture that we have today, to restore healthier ecosystems where they've been degraded or removed or fragmented. Those all seem like good things that are worth doing anyway to me.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, totally. For instance, you know, I mean, we read and hear everywhere that, you know, for instance, agriculture is actually the bad boy, you know, in this climate change, or one of the, you know, bad boys. And yet from the other side, you know, we could maybe can reduce, you know, the carbon, you know, the CO2, you know, by, you know, using new technology, different cars and everything. And it's actually also not happening. You know what I'm saying? So on the some level, you know, here we are using permaculture and we are trying to do anything, you know, from our side. Yet on the other side, some people who could actually do something or help us with that, you know, they are kind of, you know, digging the heels and not willing to change it.
Yes. Yes. And
just kind of trying to throw out there.
Yes, that's one of the things that we, I think one of the weaknesses sometimes in permaculture is maybe we look so much at the solutions that we forget that our own backyards aren't enough to do something as big as climate change. Mm-hmm. We can make a big difference in our own backyards and in our neighborhoods and so on. But this also requires being part of a global movement that says no to fossil fuels, that divests money from fossil fuels, that works for taxes on fossil fuels or some other, whatever your favorite kind of model is for mm-hmm. for dealing with that, and that helps to provide some relief for the places in the world that have done the least to cause climate change but are affected the most by it. In particular, I think about I have lots of family in Guatemala. My wife's family is from there, and we've been to visit some communities there where if it's a really dry year, people don't have enough food to eat, and their children really suffer and so on. And so this provides enough, and it happens that in terms of carbon farming, the practices that sequester the most carbon, that most effectively fight climate change, work best in the tropics. So it's a chance for some money to go to pay for things, for agricultural improvements in those countries where they are really needed, where they could make a really big difference, where they could help people adapt to climate change the most. And that helps to sort of right some wrongs at the same time. Not that we don't have good carbon farming techniques for colder climates, but we don't have the very most powerful ones, the highest ranked ones, don't work here yet on a commercial scale. Although I've spent my life moving us in that direction, and we're much closer than we've ever been to being able to have a farm scale food forest of people are putting in, you know, 5 and 10, maybe 10 acre commercial food forests and stuff, but we don't have 1,000 acre food forests here the way that you can see those kinds of things happening sometimes in mm-hmm, more tropical locations. Mm-hmm. So like I'm going to be in Mexico next week teaching, and in the region I'll be in, everywhere you just up in the mountains, and everywhere you go, you see coffee growing in the shade of other trees, and often they're useful trees. They're timber trees or fruit trees. You'll see bananas and macadamias and avocados growing over the coffee. We don't really have anything quite like that that's really ready for commercial prime time here yet. Although not people yet, are,
yes. Mm-hmm.
Where people are working on it, the early innovation farmers are going at it, which is awesome. But in the meantime, this does provide an opportunity for some of the climate money to go to folks in the tropics who are really most in need. That seems like good news to me as well, that we can sort of address some social justice issues.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, from the other side, my interest is actually, you know, look at what's going on here in the middle of the country here, Midwest. You know, we have so much rain and everything else. And, you know, these folks are suffering. You know, I always like to, you know, start, you know, what's going on home.
Yep. Well, it's really interesting because a lot of the solutions we look at, my book is mostly focused on mitigation. And that is the things mm-hmm. that fight climate change by sequestering carbon or sometimes by reducing emissions. But it's also very much equally important to look at adaptation. How do we survive in a new, crazier climate? And almost all the strategies that are really good at sequestering carbon are also really good at adaptation. So in our own Midwest, the more we can switch to increasingly perennializing our annual crop production, whether that's sometimes they put in strips of perennial grasses on contour in those crop fields, or strips of trees, or really intercropping with trees, whether they're for nuts or for fruits or for timber or something else.
To stabilize the soil.
Or they mm-hmm. are working on perennial grains, which will be ready to fill some of those gaps as well. Putting in these riparian buffers, like basically planting forests along streams and rivers to help to slow the flow of water. As you increase perennial vegetation and as you increase organic matter in the soil, you build the land's water holding capacity. So you're like building sponges into the ground that hold that water. And they release it much more slowly, and that helps reduce flooding because the water trickles out more slowly instead of coming in a rush. And it's also reducing erosion at the same time because the quick moving water isn't mm-hmm. washing soil away. So these are really multifunctional solutions that can fight climate change while also helping to prevent flooding. And at the same time, many of them also fight drought, because when you build the organic matter in the soil and increase perennial vegetation, in most cases, and it's a big world, there's lots of exceptions, but in most cases, you're also building a bank in the soil to hold water for longer so that you can get through a drought longer without having.
Yeah, you look like, you know, California is facing also huge drought and stuff. So, you know, they are kind of bombarded with, you know, challenges.
And they, I think California may need to change some of the basic ways they farm that just mm-hmm. really aren't sustainable on a water basis or a number of other bases as well, in terms of that Central Valley of California. Some things need to change out there, mm-hmm. there's no doubt. Mm-hmm. And all of us are sort of relying on them to grow all the lettuce and stuff, right? So perhaps the rest of us need to step up a little bit. Like here I have a greenhouse that's unheated, so it's not burning any energy, and it's almost completely made out of recycled materials, so it's not, doesn't have a huge carbon footprint. And in that unheated insulated greenhouse, I grow vegetables all winter long, not tomatoes, but winter things like lettuces and kales and greens and carrots and beets, but also citrus like lemons and kumquats and stuff grows very nicely for us. I'm still eating, I have little kumquats. It's a kumquat tangerine cross in there, so it's a little sour orange citrus.
In Massachusetts?
Yeah, still doing well with no heat of any kind in the greenhouse.
Oh my God.
So we could be doing a lot more here. We could be putting greenhouses up next to buildings or on top of buildings to trap the extra waste heat that comes mm-hmm. out of them. Right here in my town, we have a high-speed supercomputing center. And I worked with them a little bit, and we figured out that just the waste heat from that facility alone, which is a pretty big facility, is enough to run 14 acres of greenhouses at 70 degrees all winter long.
This is amazing.
With waste heat. So you can grow a lot of food in 14 acres of greenhouses in the middle of a city. That could be a very intensive operation, you know. So there's so many opportunities for us. We're so wasteful that there's so many opportunities to tighten up the ship and to turn those wastes into resources and into raw materials, which means things like economic development. It means new jobs and business opportunities for people.
Well, see, Eric, this is this is fascinating to me right now. We are going in a direction what I absolutely love. The reason to me is, you know, that aspect is very interesting because, you know, there are so many people losing, you know, jobs and everybody's going into the fear. Oh, my God, what will I do or whatever? But people are not recognizing that we are dealing with shifting the paradigm, whatever that means. OK, and so that means that a lot of people will, you know, lose jobs. And, you know, if you are not used to that, maybe every few years you may have to do something different. You are actually doomed. But the point what I'm trying to say with that is this permaculture is giving people such an enormous variety, you know, to adjust themselves to a much different lifestyle, but actually a good lifestyle. Because, you know, you know, you can have your food, you can, you know, I mean, there's so many opportunities. But we have to kind of, you know, change, as, you know, we were talking about from the beginning, you know, redo the global civilization or the human mind that, you know, give up that, you know, one way of doing stuff, become more adjustable for the diversity.
That sounds very right to me. I'm working with, you know, I teach college students, and when I do these workshops, mm-hmm. in various places, I really encourage people to think about careers in permaculture and related fields. Like if they're in that sort of young adult age, early 20s, you know, really you could shape your whole life around this. But for anybody, there's something that you, I used to work with a lot of beginning farmers. Worked with some refugees who were starting their own farms, and with lots of immigrants and with lots of folks from Puerto Rico who aren't immigrants but have a lot of the same issues in terms of language and climate and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then also with just sort of ordinary average Americans who either young folks who want to start farms and very meaning career changers, people who wanted a midlife career change. And I always found, especially with those career changers, that there's something they, when you look at all the list of skills you need in order to do, whether it's farming or green building construction or green building retrofits or green energy or any of these kinds of things, there's always skills that people are bringing that are useful. Maybe you're good at accounting. Maybe you're good at like fabricating equipment or plumbing or electricity, or managing people, or growing things, or caring for animals, or negotiating through the legal issues and getting permits to make things happen, or organizing people to change policies in your town so that you're able to legally have composting toilets or backyard chickens or something. Everybody's got skills and opportunity and abilities that they can, and experience that they can bring to the table. You don't have to sort of quit everything you do cold turkey and start something.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes, and totally agree with that.
Farm. We need more than farmers. We need, you know, solar installers, and we need, transportation planners and all these kinds of things. So I do feel like there's lots of roles for all of us, and including there's a green chemistry movement. They're working on how to, instead of producing all the chemicals that we use today, almost all come from petroleum, natural gas. They're working on how to make them from natural materials, how to have the process of making them be much less toxic, and how to have the product and the waste products in the end be less toxic or indeed biodegradable and friendly. So the engineers, the chemists, there's good stuff happening all over the place.
That's amazing. The reason why, Eric, I'm saying that is that, you know, I'm in health and wellness for over 20 years. And what I'm recognizing that, you know, the human health is actually impacted by all these chemicals and, you know, by the technology and everything. And we are still kind of going forward. We look like nothing is, you know, happening. And I am not understanding why we are ignoring. Why don't we have a collaboration here? I'm kind of frustrated that we don't have a collaboration here.
Well, it makes complete sense to me that health and wellness is sort of a very central ecological and social
Thank
issue.
Thank you. Now you can see why I'm so fascinated.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Yes. And I do find that there appears to be a link between growing food and eating more fruits and vegetables for many people, for example. Mm-hmm. People often ask me about my garden here at home. We have this really lovely garden we've been doing for 12 or 13 years now. And people say, well, how much of your diet comes from that garden? And I can say, well, somewhere between 10 and 25%, depending on the season and so on. But the real answer is that it's not the diet that I'm not just substituting my own fruit for fruit I would have, you know, my own pears for pears I would have bought. I'm growing things that you can't buy in a store.
Thank you.
Growing
yes.
species, huge mm-hmm. diversity you can't buy in the store. And I'm growing freshness that you can't buy in the store. And that I think is really different. I remember one year our greenhouse was destroyed in a snowstorm, and that was the first time in 11 years that I had to go and buy greens at the store, like lettuce and mm-hmm. kales and stuff. And I was not impressed, even with the very best quality organic stuff. I've become very spoiled. If it's more than 2 or 3 minutes old, I'm not interested in eating it anymore. And I think that has a relationship to someone's health, you know, to be able to eat stuff of that kind of freshness and that wide diversity. I think there's all kinds of vitamins and antioxidants and whatnot in a highly diverse diet like that, that are going to do people some good.
Well, yeah, because, you know, that is actually related then to the population health. And with that, we can actually decrease, you know, the health insurance and healthcare and all those things, you know, pharmaceutical drugs and everything else. I mean, you know, and from the other side, our children are impacted by technology, with Wi-Fi's and, you know, impacting the children's health. I mean, there are so many things that we may have to kind of face down the road. Do we like it or not? So, you know, and that's why I'm so fascinated with the permaculture, is that, you know, the ethics of the permaculture is, you know, caring for the people, caring for the planet, caring for the future, and also helps, you know, to rebuild the soil, rebuild, the land and help actually with the economics and the environment.
Yeah. Do your listeners hear about permaculture all the time, or would it be useful to do a brief overview of what it is?
Please do.
Okay. Let's see. Okay. So permaculture is a movement that started in the 1970s in Australia and has since spread around the world. The ethics, as you said, are care of people, care of the planet, and fair share or fair distribution of things, whatever that means. A friend of mine describes it as ways of meeting human needs while improving the health of the ecosystems around us. And some of the ways we do that are by trying to learn how nature works and run things, and try and put our food production and our housing and infrastructure and some of our social systems modeled on that. So we look at multifunctionality, that nothing in nature has only one purpose. So a fruit tree might be providing fruit for us, but it's also perhaps providing habitat for birds and a place with nectar for pollinators. And it's providing shade, maybe for you to have a bench or to grow some shade-loving mushrooms underneath. So we're looking at that multifunctionality. And we're also looking at trying to plug the pieces together so they become more than the sum of their parts. So we might look at an individual product or individual component, like a fish, like raising fish for meat, let's say, and say, well, okay, fish make food for us and that's great, but they also make manure, and left to their own devices in a tank, they start to, you know, the water gets dirty and they become sick mm-hmm. after a while because the manure builds up. We also have this system people like of hydroponics, where they're growing vegetables in an aquatic system with lots of fertilizer in there, but people are using mostly using synthetic fertilizers for that. But we have the aquaponic solution where you take the fish water with the laden with fish manure and you run that through troughs where the hydroponic plants are growing. And instead of needing to use extra fertilizer, the plants use the fish waste as their fertilizer. And then they're actually cleaning the water so you can put it back into the fish tank again. That would be an example of taking two different separate pieces and putting them together, sort of this change in paradigm, right? To put them together, to think about what each of them are doing and what their niche is, what their way of life is, and how we can connect them to each other to create a bigger system. And we're trying to do that both on sort of a production level. Also here in our city, we have, you know, empty lots in the city, plus lots of people living in the city with a strong agricultural heritage from mostly from Puerto Rico in our town. And high rates of diabetes and low access to vegetables. Well, it's not hard to put those two things together and say, how about community
exactly.
gardens, right?
Yes.
So we're trying to do this in the humans are part of our ecosystem too. So we're trying to do that there. So permaculture as a whole, we mostly didn't invent a lot of techniques, but we've gathered techniques from all over the world looking for ones that reduce labor and increase productivity and create really good ecological benefits. And so we've got quite a lot of tools between rainwater harvesting and energy and greenhouses for those of us here in cold climates and livestock production and crop production and more energy efficient buildings and natural building materials and then some kind of regional planning things like what do you do with sprawl, with these terrible neighborhoods that have built up with where you have to drive everywhere? Well, there's practices for how to redesign those sprawl areas to make them walkable and bikeable and busable again that also create real economic development opportunities and revitalize abandoned downtowns and so on. So permaculture, that's a little bit about what permaculture is. It's something that I've been really dedicated my life to since about 1989 when I first ran into it. And almost no one was very interested. It was far from as widely appreciated then as it is now.
You did a lot of experiences.
Yeah, it's a big phase of growth right now. It's very exciting that there's so many. It used to be that I really felt like I knew almost all the permaculture teachers in the United States, for example. And now I couldn't even remotely keep up with all the people who are teaching this. It's an exciting
time
for us.
Awesome.
And as things get rockier and more difficult for people around the world, that's actually a great thing for permaculture because we're good at responding to those kinds of situations. In many cases, anyway, we can. That's where we shine sometimes.
Well, you know, people do not understand, you know, that, you know, you can actually involve yourself on the economic aspect also in the permaculture.
Absolutely. And I see there, I think there was a long time in permaculture where people were sort of allergic to making money, you know, that was considered really uncool to be part of the system and stuff. And that's just not an easy attitude to maintain for that many years. Things start to get harder on people and. So I see lots of really interesting enterprises coming along. There's lots of people teaching permaculture and lots of people doing designs and consulting, people doing farms, people doing building businesses and so on. And people are now starting to even try and make the connections between businesses looking to buy raw materials and other people who are producing those raw materials in a regenerative and environmentally friendly way. So we've come a long way as a movement and we have a long way to go. One of the sort of areas of growth and learning for us is about really moving up to that big scale farm. And
I was listening when you were talking about the bigger picture. That actually, you know, creating smaller farms, they are much more, much better productive than, you know, have a huge landscape.
Well, there is a really good argument for breaking up huge, large farms into smaller farms. One is that even the United States Department of Agriculture agrees that smaller farms produce more per acre, whether you measure it in dollars, in calories or in pounds. Just you can do more on a smaller farm. And if one of the challenges we face is, you know, growing population, growing population while we're trying not to clear any more land for agriculture in order to maintain biodiversity and maintain the carbon in those forests and stuff, then growing more land, growing more food on the land we have is the way to do that. Another really key thing is more resources for women farmers. It looks like women around the world, female farmers, get about 7% of the resources that male farmers do, but they grow, huge amounts. I can't remember the exact percent, but a huge percentage of the world's food. And if we just provided female farmers with the kinds of financing and some of the other resources that are available to male farmers, that would increase global food production by 10 or 20%.
Wow, that's a great information.
That would be really great. So there are all these things we can do that that are good to do anyway, that climate change gives us a sort of an excuse to get around to doing that should have happened, that bring important causes to light and provide some extra and deserved attention for them, which is one of the things I'm excited about the book. And also it's certainly it's bringing attention to practices like permaculture that maybe have not been in the mainstream of agriculture. There's a brand new book called Permaculture and Climate Change Adaptation. It just came out in the US a few days ago, and it's all about different permaculture strategies to respond to and handle climate change on farms. It's mostly looking at Europe, but a lot of it's applicable here. And it's really nice because it has case studies from all over the world of how permaculture has been useful to neighborhoods, to communities, to farms, in responding to climate change, and how the permaculture toolkit has been taken up and sort of individualized and customized for different places, because we don't really think of there being a, it's not something you just replicate and hammer out over and over again. Permaculture has to be sort of adapted and made a little bit unique to each individual site based on the challenges and constraints and opportunities of that site, and the needs of the people who are involved. So it's nice to sort of, this book is sort of a harvest of that process having happened all over the world. It's a very nice new book.
Wow. Is it anything, we have maybe around 6-7 minutes, Eric, is there anything you would like to share about your own book? Anything, more information?
Sure. Let's see. Well, the very brief overview of the book is, first I look at what's happening. I sort of give the overview of what's happening with climate change, how agriculture is currently contributing in a bad way to climate change, and what's its potential to fight that, to reverse that process, and the sort of multifunctional, the multiple benefits of these kinds of strategies. And then I look at different practices, better ways to grow livestock and crops. I profile all these staple crops. I profile these industrial crops to replace petroleum. Excuse me, not so much for energy, but for materials and chemicals. Mm-hmm. And then I look at the sort of policy and implementation questions. What can a community organization do? What can an individual person do? One of the big issues is that implementing these changes on a farm, it takes time and money for farmers, two things that are in short supply.
Yeah.
So what are the different things people are thinking about to get money in the hands of farmers to make it possible for them to do this? So governments can provide grants, and around the world, that's something that happens in many places. And certainly banks and so forth can do loans, and people who are divesting from petroleum are getting interested in investing in carbon farming. One of the things I'm really excited about is the notion of a certification program that would be like organic certification, only it would be carbon farming certification, and you would know, it would give people who have the resources to do so the chance to pay a small premium price to say thank you to farmers who are fighting climate change from the way they farm. So these are some of the many ways, and I look at a whole bunch of other ways as well that we can help farmers make that difference. Because the message to farmers from the book really is, we can't do this without you.
Exactly, exactly.
And we have to step up and help you out. And many of these things are things that farmers want to do anyway, and they just lack the resources to make it possible. They don't need us to keep paying the money for 100 years to do this. You know, they just need some help to get over that hump, to get up and running with these practices. And so that's one of my hopes, is to actually to help get access for some of that money. And then also there is climate change funding. There's hundreds of billions of dollars of climate change funding, and only 2% goes to agriculture right now. So I am hoping the book provides some leverage to make that happen as well.
Wow. So let us know, let our listener know, how can, you know, they access your book, and, you know, actually I'll let them know also if they wanted to, you know, get in contact with you, how they can, you know, find you.
Great. Well, people can reach me through the website, which is carbonfarmingsolution.com. They can also order a copy of the book there, but you can get it from other places, wherever you normally get books, your local bookstore, online booksellers. And it's also a great thing to have your library order, and then, or get it through interlibrary loan from someone else's library. I'm committed to making sure that the information from the book is out there for people, whether they have money to buy it or not. So I'm putting more and more of it up on the website over time. And libraries are a great way to get your hands on pricey books. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a phenomenal, amount of information. I'm so happy that you were able to make it. Is there anything else you would like actually to share with our listeners before we close?
Two more minutes or so?
Yeah.
Oh, well, first I'd like to say thank you for having me on the show. And
my pleasure.
And encourage people to get to know some of the permaculture folks in their community. You can go to Permaculture Global. I think it's permacultureglobal.com. It's website, Permaculture Global, and it'll help you find people wherever you may live who are involved in permaculture, so you can get plugged in and find out more about how you might do things if you have your own place, or if you're renting, or if you're looking for somewhere else to plug in and get your hands dirty a little bit. That's a great network to help get people involved.
Oh, that's perfect. The reason why, look, like I said in the beginning of the show, the reason why I am, you know, bringing all this kind of information, because I don't think that a lot of people are still not thinking that we are in a pretty serious situation. And if we do not step up, we may not have too much left over, you know, for ourselves, our children, or our grandchildren. And I think this is a great way. And look, like I said, I am fascinated that, you know, permaculture can do so many things. And it brings actually a huge hope that it's possible to turn around. But we have to step up. That's the whole thing.
I feel that way as well. And I feel like just feelings of discouragement are one of the primary barriers to doing something about climate change, as well as various other problems we face in the world. And
well, yeah, but also, you know, this is why I'm saying, if people don't have enough information, they don't know where to look for it, so they are staying in this desperation. And all of a sudden, you know, when you can find, you know, this information that can, you know, change actually and turn around. And look, like I said, for me, it's fascinating that so many things can be turned out in a very short period of time.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Even though, you know, I mean, it takes a lot of work, but also it takes a commitment. So let's hope that, you know, our listener can understand from the deeper level what we are trying to do, you know, spread the message here. And Eric, I'm so thankful that you made it. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a real treat. And thanks for your patience in having me go to Paris instead of making our first date. And
and congratulations for your book.
Worked out perfect.
Yes. Okay. Thank you so much. Good night. And good night, everybody.